welcome to Spotlight on Science at the Smithsonian. This is Volume 4, Number 6, released on March 17th, 2006. In this edition of Spotlight, we take a look at life cycles as revealed by some things bright and beautiful and other creatures great and small. From the birth of suns and the diversity of plants they nourish, to sickness in animals and the microbes that may one day help decompose them, this issue has something to tempt everyone. Now here's David Evans, the Smithsonian Undersecretary for Science.
In this installment of the Spotlight Podcast, we'll look at nests of stellar gas that give birth to sibling stars. Smithsonian Astrophysical Observatory researchers will explain how evidence gathered from distant clouds of dust may explain why our own sun seems to have no brothers or sisters in the nearby galactic neighborhood. Then, we'll explore the ingredients that may have led to the diversity and coexistence of rainforest plants. A Smithsonian Tropical Research Institute scientist explains how the success of a variety of fig trees may reveal key attributes shared by members of diverse communities of plants. While in the tropical forest, we'll answer the cry of the toco toucan and find out why they are susceptible to diabetes, and more importantly, how it is being treated by the National Zoological Park veterinarians. Finally, we'll face death and rebirth, as Smithsonian Environmental Research Center scientists reveal the role of the smallest microbes in speeding along the cycle of decomposition and nutrient release in freshwater streams.
First, we travel to the Smithsonian Astrophysical Observatory in Cambridge, Massachusetts, where research on primordial stellar structures enlightens the family history of our own sun. Astronomers have learned that the vast majority of stars form in clusters of hundreds or even more, and not as isolated objects. It seems that when the star's nursery, a cloud of gas and dust in space, is massive enough to give birth to one star efficiently, it's usually capable of birthing many more. This observation raises many new questions, including whether the process of multiple star formation occurs all at once, or over a long time, whether the shape of the cloud, its primordial structure, makes any difference to the masses or quantities of the newborns, and closest to home, if our own sun formed in such a cluster, where are its siblings? A team of six SAO astronomers, led by Paula Teixeira, together with five colleagues from other institutions, have published conclusions of their study of one young cluster located about 2,400 light-years from Earth. Using the Spitzer Space Telescope, the scientists found that this cluster includes 17 young stars, all less than about a million years old. These young stars are distributed in linear substructures that seem to lie along dust and gas filaments, arranged more or less like radial spokes in the cloud. The astronomers conclude that star formation in this cloud tended to occur within these linear structures. They also find that the separations between the stars are in good agreement with theories that suggest that stellar birth results not from some external trigger mechanism, like a shock wave, but rather from the internal trade-offs between supporting gas pressure and gravitational collapse. Interestingly, the team observed that the mass of residual gas and dust in the filamentary structures is larger than the mass in all the stars. As a result, when the residual gas and dust eventually dissipates, as they will due to the pressure of radiation and winds emanating from the newborn nuclear furnaces, their gravity will no longer be able to hold the new stars together in their cluster, allowing the stars to drift apart. These observations help to explain why and how the majority of stars form in clusters, and why many stars later move away from their birthplaces. Indeed, if our sun formed in such a stellar family, this gravitational action could explain why its siblings are not in evidence today. If you'll excuse the pun, we'll now take a Newtonian view of the fig as a model of the development of tropical forest diversity. Figs are as prevalent in tropical forests as they are prominent in world mythologies. Some believe the fabled Tree of Knowledge referred to in the Book of Genesis was a fig, and the tree's leaves were the first loincloths. Because the fig's flower is often mistaken for its fruit, Buddhist and Hindu writings use the phrase seeking flowers in a fig tree to denote a pointless search. For one Smithsonian researcher, however, a census of fig trees has been anything but pointless, yielding kernels of knowledge well worth the scientific quest. A surprising variety of ficus species are found in all lowland tropical rainforests. These figs have evolved to occupy an extraordinary diversity of niches, and many are rare or low density. Figs also play a vital functional role in tropical forests because their fruits are eaten by large numbers of animals and because many species are important in forest succession. Smithsonian Tropical Research Institute associate researcher Rhett Harrison studied the striking diversity of figs to try to elucidate one of the seminal questions in tropical ecology. What has led to the evolution and coexistence of the diverse species that comprise tropical rainforests? By comparing florulas, or plant species present in a defined area, of 17 tropical lowland rainforests, Harrison found that ficus is the only ubiquitously diverse genus in lowland tropical rainforests. Ficus had the highest number of species in all but three sites in the Old World, where it still ranks second, and was also diverse across neotropical sites, especially those with the highest overall plant diversity. This research indicates that ficus must have several attributes that contribute to the assembly of diverse communities within lowland tropical rainforests. These probably include evolutionary flexibility, as a result of a pioneer character, long-range seed dispersal, an efficient long-distance pollination system, and occupancy of low-competition niches. If these attributes are important to the success of the oh-so-successful fig, they're also likely to be important for the diversity of other tropical rainforest plants. There's much opportunity for further research on ficus. Figs make a good model for comparative studies, given the large number of species, a highly specific pollination system, and its diverse symbionts. Many aspects of the evolutionary ecology of fig species remain unstudied. Further research in these areas promises to contribute to the overall understanding of tropical rainforests. While figs may be sweet, diabetes isn't. A toucan at the National Zoo is currently recovering from a bout with this debilitating condition. The toco toucan, Ramphastos toco, is found throughout the lowlands of South America. These instantly recognizable birds, with large, colorful bills, are susceptible to iron overload, or hemosiderosis, which can lead to iron storage disease and cause liver problems and diabetes. A female toco toucan at the National Zoo was medically evaluated because she was lethargic in drinking large amounts of water. Blood tests showed that she had very high levels of glucose and iron. Her blood glucose levels were about 1,700 milligrams per deciliter. Normal for toco toucans is 200 to 300 milligrams per deciliter. The diagnosis? Diabetes mellitus caused by iron storage disease. It's thought that iron depositions in the pancreas, in addition to the liver, causes destruction of islet cells and leads to decreased insulin production. Therefore, treatment to decrease her iron levels was initiated, and both disease processes were treated simultaneously. Treatment involves an oral hypoglycemic, to decrease blood sugar, and an injectable chelator, which binds iron and excretes it from the body. Once a week, a moderate amount of blood is taken from the toucan to stimulate her body to create new red blood cells, and thereby use more iron from the liver without causing anemia. In addition, the toucan is receiving small amounts of tannin-rich black and green decaffeinated tea in her low-iron diet. Tannins decrease iron absorption. Reducing the iron levels is a long-term process. Blood glucose levels have recently fallen to levels that are still high, 500 to 575 milligrams per deciliter, but close to normal, showing signs of progress. This is expected to be followed by improvement and hopefully eventual resolution of the diabetes. The iron storage disease will likely need lifelong management in this toucan. She'll receive a modified diet and regular monitoring once she returns to her exhibit at the birdhouse. Finally, in this edition of Spotlight, we use our pulpit to give protists their props by exploring how eukaryotic microbes contribute to the decomposition of leaf litter in streams. In the circle of life, there's an unseen and oft underappreciated microscopic world of decomposers that are responsible for releasing the latent energy in decaying matter. Among these little engines that could is the protist, or eukaryotic microbe. Scientists at the Smithsonian Environmental Research Center in Edgewater, Maryland, are helping reveal just how much credit these little scavengers deserve. Research has shown that protists, as well as bacteria, are involved in the decomposition of organic matter, including hay and seagrasses. However, the prominence of the role of protists in this process in streams has remained a mystery. Susanna Riblett and D. Wayne Coates from CERC and Margaret Palmer from the University of Maryland College Park recently published a paper in Freshwater Biology that provides an in-depth examination of the decomposition of stream leaf litter. Senescence, or programmed cell death, and decay of leaf tissue is a major source of nutrients for aquatic food webs that rely on organic waste material. Decomposition of this material involves the leaching of water-soluble compounds into the stream, microbial colonization and growth, and finally, mechanical breakup by invertebrates. This decomposition process is influenced by temperature, water flow, leaf chemistry, and consumption. Bacteriurus, or bacteria-eating protists, are hypothesized to control bacterial abundance. To study the role of bacteriurus protists in stream leaf decomposition, the researchers collected samples of crushed, recently senesced box elder leaves from Goose Creek in northern Virginia. They soaked the leaves in distilled water and, after allowing 14 days for leaching, treated them with either bacteria only, bacteria and flagellates, which are protists with long, whip-like organelles called flagella, or bacteria, flagellates, and ciliates, protists with short, hair-like organelles called cilia. They then compared rates of decomposition, dry leaf weight, and microbe abundance to sterile controls. They discovered that treatment groups containing protists had significantly higher rates of decomposition as well as reduced bacterial abundance and leaf weight compared to the sterile controls and bacteria-only treatments. These results indicate that bacteriurus protists play a major role in the decomposition process in streams. That's all for this issue of Spotlight on Science at the Smithsonian. If you haven't already subscribed to the Spotlight podcast, visit spotlight.si.edu to learn how. You can also download archived editions of Spotlight. As always, feel free to share your thoughts with the Spotlight team at spotlight@si.edu.